This is the podcast for Monday, February 28th, 2011, Theories of Knowledge. So today we're going to talk about how much control you have over your beliefs and then move right into discussing religious knowledge. And then I think we're going to save, we might get to moral knowledge on Thursday, or might put it off for the last week. It depends on, I suppose, how many things we have to discuss and whether it seems we've exhausted or not. It's always tough to know at the end of the term how much time you should spend on certain topics. Maybe we'll feel after today that we've kind of beat the religious topic like a dead horse, and we should move on to other things. But I wanted to talk about this section at the end of Beliefs and Will, and it is on Can We Freely Choose Our Beliefs? It's on page 200. Can we freely choose our beliefs? If we can, should we exercise this ability? And this comes out as an important issue in the ethics of belief, in that if you really don't have control over your beliefs, then it seems not to make any sense to talk about the ethics of belief. Because the ethics assumes that you have a choice to make between two real alternatives, and that you can be blamed for making the good choice, praised for making a good choice and blamed for making a bad choice. That's usually how it goes, although often it's the other way around. But you can be appropriately blamed for making a bad choice and appropriately praised for making a good choice. So W.K. Clifford talks a lot about this idea of the moral quality of belief, that if you let your belief rest on an unworthy object, that it's a stain that can be never wiped away, that it's a sin against mankind, a sin against knowledge, when you form a belief and believe anything without sufficient evidence. And that raises the question, well, how much control do you really have over your beliefs? So a couple of terms which will be on the final exam. Again, anything bold, if it isn't bold, you should think, I either got to know what that means, or I got to memorize the definition, or I got to put it on my note card. And hopefully, maybe all three. You will be asked sometimes to identify particular cases or apply concepts. So memorization, rote memorization may get you a C on the exam, but probably not a B or an A. But it has its place. And so, and memorization is a step before application, interpretation application. So first you have to have a factual base, and then you have to understand it in a deep way, and then you have to understand it in an even deeper way to apply it to particular cases. So there's kind of tiers of understanding. And so the way I have my test set up, if you sort of can memorize rote concepts and kind of know what's going on, you can get a C in the test. If you have a little more deeper understanding, you should be able to get a B. And if you really understand what's going on, you'll need to do that to get an A, that you can't just sort of memorize words and the way words are stringed together and hope to get a good grade on the test. So that's part of what our class discussion is. If there's some concept that isn't quite making sense to you, raise your hand and ask about it, please. Okay, volitionism and epistemology. So epistemology, the theory of knowledge, right? Volitionism. What does volitionism mean? It's the idea that you have free will with regard to your beliefs. It comes from volition. The idea that you have as a volition is just this word that has to do with being able to take an action or initiate an action. So volitionism just means having free will in beliefs. And then you get two different kinds. One is descriptive volitionism. Descriptive volitionism is a psychological theory. And all it says is that you have some control over your beliefs. It doesn't say whether you should exercise it, whether exercising your control over your beliefs is good or bad. It just says that you have some control over what you believe. And then that can take the form of either direct control, like William James's will to believe, right? James says, well, there's some beliefs like belief in God and the afterlife that even if the evidence isn't sufficient, you can make a decision to believe. You make that will to believe in spite of insufficient evidence, and it's okay because it meets these really narrow criteria. So that's a direct volition, and also with Kierkegaard, right? Kierkegaard says you can take a leap of faith. that even if all the evidence is against your view, even if belief in God seems absurd and Christianity seems like a ridiculous superstition, you can still believe in it. And you take that leap of faith. Kierkegaard's famous for this book called Fear and Trembling. And I think it's in that book where he described the evangelist as being like a clown in a circus. And the circus is on fire. And the crowd is there enjoying the show. And the clown runs out to warn people. And he's in his clown makeup with his floppy shoes and his makeup on. And he's there usually to, like, you know, make jokes and make people laugh. And so he's running around saying, there's a fire going on, there's a fire going on, waving his hands around and you know, his floppy shoes, his big poofy suit, you know, and people are like laughing, like, oh, look, you know, it's some story about like a fire and the clown's all panicked and isn't that funny, right? And you see cartoon characters kind of racing around with exaggerated sort of worrying about things and you're like, oh, you know, this is like part of the show, right? And then the tent burns down, all the people inside die. And that's sort of the idea that Kierkegaard has of the evangelist, the person who exhorts people to embrace faith, is seen as ridiculous by the majority of people. And the majority of people are going to perish in their unbelief. Why? Because they see the evangelist as being like a clown. And it's only when you put aside your rationality, your intellect, your Kierkegaard might even say intellectual elitism, and take the childlike faith that Jesus talked about, that you finally, you know, get it and have this deep meaning and purpose in your life and avoid the things. But Kierkegaard says you can do that. You and not only can but should, and you can take this leap of faith even if the evidence makes it look ridiculous. And he has a thing where he says, well, look, imagine, you know, think about Christian apologetics. Again, this Christian, you mentioned, this will be a good term for the test too, which I don't know that I had in the text. Does anybody know offhand whether I used the term Christian apologetics in bold in the text?
I don't remember it.
Apologetics generally is the idea of defending a certain view. And then Christian apologetics is the defense of the Christian faith. In an academic, intellectual way. So it was
defending a particular point of view. And then you have a person who's called an apologist. Sometimes an apologist is used in kind of a negative way today. A person who sort of in knee-jerk fashion defends everything that a particular group does. Like you might say a person is an apologist for Islamic fundamentalism. Every time, you know, some Saudi engineering student is on the internet looking for things to build bombs with and researching bombs, and he's writing his journal about how he longs to be a martyr for the faith and he loves jihad. They're like, oh, that's just he's just an isolated extremist, some Arab nationalist that has nothing to do with his religion, even though, you know, jihad is a religious term. He's talking about being a religious martyr. Or when you have this fellow, Fort Hood, who's talking to some extremist cleric, and the Navy looks like, oh, he's just doing some academic research. And then he pulls out a gun and kills half a dozen people and wounds a bunch more, shouting Allahu Akbar, which means God is great in Arabic. Oh, he is having problems with his marriage and couldn't pay his mortgage. That's why he killed all those people. Right? That's, so you get these groups like CARE, the Council of Islamic Affairs, Council of American
Islamic Relations.
Council on American Islamic Relations. So CARE is sometimes called an apologist for Islam. But apologist in the classical sense just means a person who is a defender of the faith, and it seems sort of as a good thing. So apologist, defender of a certain point of view. back during Clinton's impeachment proceedings, there'd be people who'd be Christian, or, sorry, Clinton apologists. Very different than a Christian apologist. So they'd say, well, you know, it was just, you know, a little dalliance. It didn't have anything to do with perjury or obstruction of justice and so on. And again, they're just, you know, defending him no matter what because they're his political operatives. So the apologist in the classical sense is just a person who would give arguments or reasons why a particular point of view is true, to give reasoned arguments. And this comes from the Greek word apologia, which means to give a defense in court. So you get the apology of Socrates, for example, by Plato. Socrates. So the apology of Socrates. It's not Socrates saying he's sorry. As a matter of fact, Socrates is anything but sorry. He's kind of obnoxious and practically dares the jury to give him the death penalty. But it's his defense in court. So anyway, the long and short of this is this term apologetics has to do with giving a reasoned defense in terms of logical arguments. Reasons to believe. And we'll get into this when we talk about religious knowledge. So, you know, you can do this with the Bible. You can say, look, here's a story about the city of Jericho. And the story says, it gives a geographical description of where Jericho is. And it cites certain events as having occurred. So what people did is they looked at the description of the Bible. They looked at maps of ancient Israel. And they go around there and like, it's got to be around here. Here's like the traditional site for the city of Jericho, or here's where everyone, you know, this sort of the tradition says it is, and here's this matches the description of the Bible. Let's start digging. And then they find these walls, right? And they're like, wow, there really was. And they find tablets and they find evidence of the city actually called Jericho. Now in the 19th century, people thought Jericho was a myth. They thought Troy was a myth, and then they dug up the city of Troy. And so like an apologist for the Bible might say, well, look, the Bible tells the story of the city of Jericho, how the walls fell out. And you dig up the walls and you're like, hey, the walls fell out. It looks like the walls really did fall out. And it looks like the city of Jericho was burned to the ground and destroyed in just the way the Bible describes. So you chalk one up for the Bible. And then you just go on to the next thing. And so that's the sort of idea. Now, what does Kierkegaard think about that sort of idea? Is that a good way to try to persuade people to become Christians or to embrace faith? Yeah.
Yeah. Faith isn't going to come by objectivity or reason. It basically says it's a passion. It's like, it's all subjective. Like, if you proved everything in the Bible, it wouldn't convince any more atheists to become believers. And if you disproved everything in the Bible, it wouldn't convince any Christians to stop believing it.
Yeah, faith is seen as being a choice. Someone who's posting the online forum that keeps on saying it's a choice. It's a choice to have faith. It's a choice to embrace love. And I was thinking, well, of course people make a choice, but some people choose against faith. And why do they choose against faith? Well, they regard it as there being insufficient evidence. So the idea that Kierkegaard has is that even if there is insufficient evidence, you should believe anyway. And that's an example of exercising your will to believe. And so you can see Clifford says, this gets to the sort of this idea of not descriptive volitionism, but prescriptive volitionism. So descriptive volitionism just says you have some control over your beliefs. And it could be either direct, like James or Kierkegaard. So James, direct. Descriptive volitionism. So that would be like James, and I'm just going to put S-T-K right off Kierkegaard. The literature, usually you'll see people write S-K because they get tired of writing out Kierkegaard every time. So it's just S-K, sort of Kierkegaard. So, and then there's indirect I don't think we talked about this much. Indirect, again, still descriptive volitionalism. And this you get in Pascal, and I think also in Clifford too. Although Clifford is a sort of a different version than I think than Pascal. So what does Pascal say? What if you can't believe? What if it just seems too absurd? What if you have maybe you have a little bit of faith, but it's not enough to kind of push you over the fence, and you always find yourself, well, okay, I have all these religious friends, I have all these experiences, and I read all these accounts and these books my friends give me. But on the other hand, you know, I have all my atheist friends and they think it's a bunch of nonsense. It's like believing in Santa Claus. And then, like, well, on the one hand, I wonder, like, how did the world get here if it doesn't have a first cause? But on the other hand, I think, well, you know, why is there so much evil in the world? If God is all powerful and all good, whence comes evil? And so you go back and forth and not really sure. And then what does Pascal suggest that you should do?
Pragmatic.
Yeah, this pragmatic. So he says you should wager on God. But then what if you can't? I mean, what if you can't? So the idea is that, okay, you decide it's in your best interest to believe in God. But you just can't bring yourself to do it. You're like, oh, you sort of try really hard. You're like, I believe. And then, you know, I still don't believe. Or what are you going to do? You try to whip yourself into a frenzy. What are you supposed to do? He actually gives some practical advice, being a pragmatist.
Get some holy water.
Yeah, go to Mass, have the priest sprinkle some holy water on you, start praying a lot, read the Bible. This is sort of like the advice you get from Dale Carnegie, you know. What if you don't feel happy today? What if you feel kind of down and dumped? But you want to be happy. So put a smile on your face, right? And all of a sudden it's like, hey, I feel a little bit happier. Walk with a spring in your step, right? Hold your chin up high, and pretty soon you're like, I do feel pretty happy. Right, and doors before you're depressed. So the idea is that you need to take that first step. And so for Pascal, you start acting in religious ways, and that's going to kind of help you believe, and maybe get rid of your atheist friends who are a bad influence on you. Start going to church a lot more. Maybe get some Christian books and maybe some tapes to play in the car. Some CDs, right? Listen to, and start. Let's stop listening to that death metal and put on some Michael W. Smith or maybe some old gospel tunes, right? And pretty soon you're like, yeah, maybe there is a God.
Reggae.
Christian reggae. See, that's the thing. It's got to be Christian music, right? Maybe put on some Gregorian chants if you're like a Catholic type, right? Get you in kind of that otherworldly mood. And so the idea is that you sort of try to. Condition yourself to believe indirectly, and this is just Pascal's view. So think about this, and again, come back to kind of a political context, because politics and religion are sort of all-encompassing views. They have a lot of effects on people's. They're a big part of people's worldview, and so you think about suppose like you're a business owner. And you're living in Texas. Texas is a red state. You go down to the Chamber of Commerce, they're all a bunch of goddamn Republicans. And you're like, how am I ever going to make it here? And they all go down to like the local GOP headquarters. If people who are hooked into the party machine seem to make a lot of business contacts. And you tell them you're a Democrat, and they kind of make a face. And so they're like, maybe they smile politely, but you can tell that that after they shake your hand, they maybe see them wipe it off with a handkerchief or something. Right? So you think, well, gosh, even though I don't really believe that the Republican Party is the way to go, I'm in Texas, and I think it's in my best interest of my business to make those connections, to play ball with the old boys network, and to get myself ensconce myself in the old boys network. I'm going to become a Republican. But every time I listen to Rush Limbaugh on the radio, I just want to strangle him. And every time I think about like Republicans, I just like
I just want to scream, right? So what do? Well, the idea is that you'd like maybe force yourself to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. And maybe you like, you know, go to a Tea Party rally, kind of sit quietly in the back. And maybe, you know, somebody comes up to you say it and says hi, and they're like really friendly. You're like, oh, Republicans aren't so bad after all. And pretty soon you're like, you know, you're reading like the writings of Jefferson and Madison. You're talking about limited government, individual freedom. And you're like, you know, I kind of believe in freedom. And the Democrats, Michelle Obama, is always telling me what to eat. She wants to eat carrot sticks while she's porking out on ribs, and I don't really like that. And then eventually, you're listening to Rush, and you're calling him up, maybe saying, "Make a dittos, Rush, you know, I'm a convert." Or maybe you call up Sean Hannity and tell him you've been anatized, and they play the harp music in the background, right? Because you like start listening, it starts making sense. Why? Because you're exposing yourself to it over and over and over again. And maybe you could ditch your communist friends and make some new Republican friends. So it's the same sort of idea that you indirectly condition, you set up your life so that it's set up to produce certain beliefs. It's the same sort of idea. Now what, so this is this idea that of you can indirectly change your beliefs. Now the question is, should you do that? So prescriptive volitionism. You can and should choose your beliefs. Using non evidence related. Non-evidence related means. So the idea is you're not proportioning your beliefs with the evidence like Clifford, but what you're doing is you're putting a mental finger on the balance so it tips the other way. Right, so you're thinking, okay, well, I have these two ideas, say belief and unbelief. And it's kind of teetering back and forth. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to exercise my will to believe and maybe do certain things, sort of brainwash myself, trying to get myself to believe one way or the other. I'm going to kind of tip the scale here and get to go like this. The tips towards belief. So what do you think about that as a sort of idea? Is that something you should do? Is there anything wrong with doing that? I mean, it's going to be in your long-term best interest, right? You can't really tell one way or the other. This is the sort of, the pragmatic argument. You want to believe things which are good for you. It's going to be in your long-term best interest. And so you kind of decide that you're going to, since you can't really tell what's true, for sure, you decide to believe what's going to be best. Yeah.
I just don't see how that would work in the long run for me. You know, I've tried to look at somebody's side for a while and analyze it and everything, and then you come to the conclusion that this just isn't working. I don't know if I could just believe another belief or want to just because I wanted to, or to fit in.
Yeah.
Kind of like what you were saying earlier, where me and my brother have this thing we say, act as if, like when you're kind of depressed or you're not really feeling good, to get yourself out of it. Like you even said it, like put a bounce in your step, and act as if, put a smile on your face. And eventually, because the power of your mind will let you be, you'll get out of your depression or unhappy state just by act as if, by putting yourself in a happy state of mind, it'll come to you because you have the power to choose.
And the idea that belief is going to come on its own accord, that you can kind of coax it along, that you can't just sort of, it's not, belief isn't something you can sort of do. It's not like you say, I choose to believe this. I think about this idea that you have direct control over your belief seems kind of implausible, right? I choose to believe. I don't have my heart holding a marker in my hand. I choose to believe it's not raining outside. I choose to believe George Washington wasn't the first president of the United States. And then you kind of go down the line, and maybe it seems a little bit easier with some other things, right? You think about, it seems like when you have something you vacillate back and forth where the evidence is ambiguous, you might go back and forth. Go ahead.
What you said about, like, it's raining outside in George Washington, most people know that George Washington was the first president, and you can know it's raining outside, just, you know, everyone had to walk outside to get here. You can't really believe something you know. And I feel like you have to, the question of belief has to be something you can't know for sure, like God's existence.
Okay, so you think that if something, the more uncertain something is, the more control you have over it?
Well, no, just what you were saying.
You think it's an all or nothing thing?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be, to believe something, it has to be something you can't just, like, know.
But aren't there things that...
believing and knowing.
Aren't there things that people, that some people know, that other people have false beliefs about, though?
Well, then they just falsely know something.
Well, you can have false knowledge.
It's raining outside. Not necessarily the fact that God exists.
Well, it's either a fact that God exists or he doesn't exist, right?
Well,
there's
yeah,
no sort of in between.
You can't know.
Yeah, so all you're assuming.
We know it's raining outside.
It's your belief that you can't know God exists.
Fair
enough. But I mean, aren't there some things, let's leave God aside, there's some things that are in between, like God, which is sort of like a more kind of cosmic, theoretical thing, maybe, and like, you know, there's a hand in front of my face. It seems like there's lots of things like, the budget problems in Wisconsin are due to government unions, right? That's an empirical claim. There's all sorts of economic factors involved. People have their views on it. And there's evidence, you know, that's put forth on either side. It seems like there's a determinate answer to that, but people still disagree on it. And then the question is, like, you know, as a member of a union, right, I'm the OEA, you know, there's this call for everybody to go up to Salem and show solidarity with our union brothers and sisters. And I kind of resent having union dues extorted out of my paycheck to go for causes I don't support. But I think that things would go a lot better for me if I was like a union Joe, like personally, in my narrow self-interest. And the more union benefits, the better for Jeffrey Borrowdale, right? If I get, you know, they're going to pay for all my health care, and I'm going to get this generous pension, and I'm going to have fewer requirements put on me for work requirements, and I have more rights. It seems that it's in my interest to get as many rights and as many benefits as possible. And so it might be good for me to, like, show solidarity with the union. But then what if, like, I'm thinking, well, I think unions are kind of an insidious bad influence in society. Might have their purpose at certain historical time periods, but now they've kind of gotten out of control. Should I suppress that belief and believe, you know, go union, because it's going to help me be better friends with, the union president who's in my department and the head of the bargaining team who's in my department and whose offices are within, you know, a few paces of mine? And, you know, who are colleagues and friends, and, you know, the majority of faculty here, you know, they love the union and support the union, and are generally bullish about government unions in particular, being members of government unions. And that's what Pascal, it seems like that's what he says you should do, is you should kind of try to gin up belief. Isn't there something fundamentally dishonest about that? Doesn't it show a lack of integrity or something? It seems like it's kind of you're trying to trick yourself into believing. And is it really like having self-confidence in yourself? Or is it more like, trying to make yourself biased to justify some thing that you don't really believe in? It seems to me like it's the latter. There's something, so one objection to this, just giving my view, is it seems sort of,
one objection, really. It seems intellectually dishonest. To try to, I mean, really, this is what people call bias, right? You're trying to create bias in your mind, which is an irrational favoring of one view over another for personal reasons, right? And people do this in politics all the time. You see, like, if someone on the other side of the political aisle makes a mistake, you're like, aha, what an idiot. He, Barack Obama doesn't know how many states there are, because he says he's been to 57 states, and there's only 50 states, right? Sorry. But, you know, come on, Barack Obama knows how many states there are. It's just, you just misspoke. If, on the other hand, you know, you look at, if you're like a, you know, left to center, and you might say, you listen to George W. Bush's speech, and he says something like, terrorists will never cease in attempting to destroy America, and neither will we. And you're like, oh, what an idiot. Listen, you're writing this bad. He wants to destroy America, right? Guy can't even put together a sentence. He must be an idiot. But, you know, he's got MBA from Harvard and scored higher than John Kerry in his military intelligence test. He's like not a dummy. And but, you know, he has problems with public speaking, so you say, oh, he's like a moron, right? And why? Well, it's because you tend to have bad feelings. You have this tendency to believe people that you have a kind of affinity towards. And so that bias is seen as, by most people, as being bad. If you're going to be objective, you got to be fair-minded. And when the other guy makes an honest mistake, you shouldn't attribute malignancy to it. You shouldn't demonize your ideological opponents, and so on and so forth. But it seems like this is really asking you to do this. It's asking you to be blind to the lack of evidence for this belief and embrace it anyway. Agree? Disagree? What do you think? Yeah.
Well, if you don't know if you believe something, except that you don't know. I mean, you can seek out the truth, but if you really just don't know, something you don't know, or speak your truth, you know, even if your voice trembles, like that saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
If other people around you believe that you don't, say it. That's like very soon.
Yeah, maybe that's the proper approach is to withhold judgment and then make an investigation to see whether or not something's true, and try to have it keep an open mind, and maybe forget about your sort of irrational biases. And I think I might have mentioned this before. This was like in the 2000 election. I had friends who said the election must have been fixed because none of their friends, you know, voted for Bush. And it's like, I'm thinking to myself, well, it's because all your friends were a bunch of communist college professors, present company accepted, right? So, like, you know, you can't think that, well, just because everyone around, people tend to surround them with people who are like them, who share common interests and values. Now, sometimes you get people that might share a common value, but then differ on other value. Like, you might have two people who love comic books or something, right? But maybe their politics are totally different, or their religion is totally different. Or you might have people who love sports, but again, they differ in their religion or politics or more fundamental things. So it's not like people don't associate with other people that are unlike them, but people tend to gravitate towards and like people who are like them. And so we, as human beings, we have this innate capacity for bias. But it seems that this view says, prescriptive volitionalism says, rather than guarding yourself against bias and letting irrational considerations other than the evidence affect us, that we should embrace it and maybe kind of push it along and create our own biases based on what we think is being good for us. And I suppose you might think it's kind of selfish too. If you're just thinking about number one. So it seems like there's some problem with this idea that Pascal has of kind of, you know, trying to gin up belief. Now, I suppose you might see this in another way. Like, there's this passage in one of the Gospels where someone says, I believe, help my unbelief, and says that to Jesus.
So you get this paradoxical statement. On the one hand, they say they have faith. On the other hand, they say they want help with their lack of faith. So the idea is they have just a little bit of faith, and Jesus says, if you have the faith, it's, the side of a seed, of a mustard seed, right? It's sort of, that's enough to get you going. Borrowdale paraphrase. Borrowdale Living Version. Right? So you have that little bit of faith, and then kind of God carries you along, I guess. But that seems different than appealing to God to help your faith and to try to gin it up yourself. And so maybe you could say, well, it's one thing to ask God for guidance in knowing what the truth is. It's another for saying, well, here's the truth which is good for me. I live in Utah. That would be my best interest to be a Mormon. And so I'm going to, go to the Mormon temple or the Mormon church. I'm going to try to be a good Mormon, I'm going to stay away from anti-Mormon literature, and you sort of try to fit in with the community. I'm going to get married and have a big family, but if you're kind of learning about the church and you've been a good Mormon, and they say, okay, there's this temple ceremony, and that's where you get your sacred temple garments, and you're like, well, what are these? And they show you these things are like. They're kind of like long johns. Maybe they got some funny symbols on them or something like that. And they're like, well, what's this? And those are your temple garments. And people tell you stories about, people being saved from in plane crashes and train crashes and automobile crashes and people who narrowly avoided being crushed by a piano because they're wearing their temple garments. And you're like, what is this magic underwear? This makes no sense. This is crazy. But then what do you do? Well, Pascal would say, push those doubts down. Don't think about them, right? Just think, okay, well, I'm going to be, at the Chamber of Commerce, and they're not going to consider me to be an unbeliever. I'm going to be one of the, I'm going to be up. People who ask me, oh, are you LDS? Latter-day Saint, Mormon. And you're like, why, yes, I am. And you can say it without a sort of a tremor in your voice or something, or something that would betray you. Because you could pretend, right? You could pretend, but then people might figure it out, right? So it's best for you to be sincere, because that way, if you really believe it, then people aren't going to doubt you. If you're kind of doing a masquerade, people are going to find out eventually. And it might be too that maybe suppose you're a goddamn atheist, right? And you're thinking, I read all these studies that say religious people have such great lives. I look at my friends who are these fundamentalist Christians, and they have great marriages, and their kids respect them, and they seem to have really good values, and making them twice as much as I am, and here I am, and I'm riddled with anxiety, I'm worrying about death, and I'm just I've got all these problems, and I'm trying to kick the bottle. And my friend Jim, he got religion, he kicked the bottle, and now he's been clean and sober, and I still got this drinking problem. And you look at all these problems, and you go, well, maybe I should just become a religious person. I can't buy into that stuff. Well, what do? You kind of go to church and read all these books about why the Bible is true, and ignore all the skeptical arguments. Stay away from David Hume. I had to stay away from skepticism.
Well, I have some friends that when they got clean off drugs, they have to go through a 12-step program that imposes a belief in a higher power. And basically, they do have to believe, whether or not they're an atheist or a theist, they do have to suppose a higher being in order to go through this process of recovery. And so, in a sense, it's beneficial even if they don't believe in it. And it's shown to work, but I don't think it's justification, but it is positive.
Yeah, I suppose, and that's the sort of idea. You have to take a leap of faith and embrace a higher power. And that's, in a way, I mean, William James would say, that's your will to believe right there. It's like you find yourself in a totally desperate situation, and what do? You push all your intellectual doubts aside, and you just make that step to believe. And then it pays off in all these benefits. You have hope, you have a meaning. You feel like God's helping you kick the bottle. Sometimes maybe you doubt whether it's just like your own mind, your subconscious mind. But then if you really make that step to believe, eventually you find yourself with this life of faith, and that's going to be preferable to the life of unbelief. And James says at the end of your life, if it turns out that you're wrong, you die and there's nothing, what are you, going back to Pascal, what have you lost? I think James and Pascal agree on that point. They agree that the life of faith is better than the life without faith. They just differ on how you create that faith. So Pascal says you can create indirectly and sort of cynically and pragmatically. James says you make a decision to believe directly. You don't have to go through this rigmarole of trying to gin up belief. Just believe. Gin up belief. Just believe. And you have the power to do that. Now, Clifford, what would Clifford say about all this? Does Clifford think you have control over your beliefs? And if so, is it direct or is it indirect?
Clifford says it's never justified to form beliefs on the basis of one's own hopes and desires, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of weird that you think about this. Would Clifford say you just sort of make a decision to believe? And I think in a certain sense, you make an intellectual decision to give your assent or dissent from a certain view. But if you think about it kind of as a policy, it has more to do with a policy of believing, in that you can decide whether to proportion your belief with the evidence or not. So it's a kind of an indirect thing, and that you decide whether to look for evidence or not. And then if you base all your beliefs on the evidence, you're not going to believe on anything there's insufficient evidence for. So I would say that Clifford says it's kind of an indirect. And that it all has to do with, it's proportion to the evidence. So you make a decision to proportion your belief with the evidence. And then the particular things you believe are going to be determined by that. So you say, I'm never going to believe anything without sufficient evidence. And then someone gives a belief for your consideration, and you say, well, what's the evidence for it? And the person says, gives you some shoddy evidence, or he gives you some evidence, but it's pretty weak. And you say, well, am I going to believe that? So it's not like every single thing that comes before you say, I freely choose to believe that, I freely choose not to believe that. You choose based on the evidence. And then you proportion how much you believe in it, how certain you are based on the evidence. So it's kind of an indirect thing, in that the evidence is kind of a mediator between your belief. It's not like you give your assent or dissent to a belief for no reason, or just sort of based on pragmatic or personal concerns, but you base it on the evidence. And Clifford would say it's immoral to do the sort of thing that James and Pascal recommend you do, which is believe what's good for you, or what's in your best interests, or even what's in the best interests of society. Yeah.
So Clifford's more concerned with justification.
Yeah, I think he thinks your duty is on believing. You have a duty to proportion your belief with the evidence, whatever it is. And it's wrong for you to let irrational bias determine your belief. To give yourself the secret pleasure of believing something that tickles your intellectual funny bone, right? It's sort of like, ooh, wouldn't it be cool if this were true? Right? And that kind of feeling of ooh, this is kind of weird and beyond mundane life, and it would be pretty cool if it was true. And then you think that kind of pattern of magical thinking is just the ruination of society. It's really bad. And so your duty is to proportion your belief in accordance with the evidence. So descriptive volitionism describes the way people's power of belief, whether or not they have control over their beliefs. Prescriptive volitionism says that you have the right to decide your beliefs on a non-rational basis. For non-rational considerations, whether it's what's personally good for you, or as some kind of religious duty, or as maybe even some kind of social duty, you're not, according to Clifford, you're not supposed to do any of those things. That you always have to look at the evidence. James says there's a few cases where it's acceptable to believe without evidence. And Kierkegaard kind of widens those cases, and basically he still says it's in religious matters. But I think Kierkegaard is a little more extreme in that he says the leap of faith is a kind of totally irrational thing, and that objective evidence is meaningless. Where I think James thinks the evidence kind of has a role to play, but it can only take you so far. Kierkegaard has this idea that it's all passion. He has a stark contrast between subjectivity and objectivity. And when it comes to God, it's got to be all subjectivity. And objectivity has no place. You can't treat God as an object. Whereas James wrote this book, a pretty famous book called Varieties of Religious Experience, where he studied all the major religions. And he said, well, here's the sort of other, there is evidence for God and the afterlife and so on, but there's also these skeptical arguments and what's a person to do. Well, kind of like the evidence kind of shows you that it's plausible, but it can't really prove it. So you kind of got to go the extra mile and kind of take a little leap of faith. But it's not. It's not sort of a leap in the dark. Kierkegaard wants you to go to the end of a cliff and like jump off and expect the angels to catch you. I mean, he really sees this as sort of a leap in the dark, or a sort of throwing yourself wholly into faith apart from all rational consideration. Two arguments against descriptive volitionalism. One is the phenomenological argument. There's that word phenomena again. So phenomenological just means it has to do with the way things seem. Right? It has to do with your experience. So remember, Kant has this distinction between noumena and phenomena. Noumena is the world in itself. Phenomena is the world as humanly experienced. So the phenomenological argument is based on our experience, the way things seem. And so when you think about how you form your beliefs, you wake up in the morning and you say, I freely choose to believe that it's 7:45. I freely choose to believe my alarm is going off. I freely choose to believe that if I press this button on the alarm clock, that it will stop making that really annoying noise. Right? You don't do that. You just kind of automatically believe it. You believe based on what your senses tell you, based on what some other people tell you. If someone who's given the flights of fancy and in the past has shown themselves to be untrustworthy, you're a little more skeptical. If someone said, if your friend who owes you $100 wants to borrow $20 more and says they'll gladly pay you Tuesday, you might be a little more skeptical. On the other hand, if your office mate who has lots and lots of money and has never borrowed a cent from you and tells you that just ask for some change for the vending machine and promises to pay you back the next day because they left their wallet at home, then maybe that's probably a pretty good bet. But it's not like you say, well, should I believe him or not? You just automatically form these beliefs based on the evidence before you. Now, if you have a more complicated case, you weigh and evaluate evidence. But that's always based on your background and circumstances and your overall belief system. And it's not like your overall belief system is something you chose either, right? It's based on the culture you grew up in, your background, who your parents were, what your socioeconomic class was, and those things. And so the phenomenological argument just says that if you think of belief, it's not something... Believing is something that happens to you. It's not something you do. It's a passive experience. It's not like you walking around all day saying, I choose to believe I have a book in my hand. I choose to believe that I'm speaking now. Right? You pick up, say you're looking on the internet, you're reading the news. I was in the news today. Wisconsin teacher strike. I think something.
So beliefs are imposed on you by the world?
It's a sort of automatic thing to do. So the idea is it's, I suppose it, in the sense that, in the sense that your beliefs are formed automatically, I suppose you could use the word imposed. Your beliefs are imposed on you in the same sense that colors and shapes are imposed on you when you open your eyes, and sounds are imposed on you when your ears aren't stopped up with earplugs, right? You just think you hear stuff. I wake up in the morning and I hear a pitter-patter sound on the roof. I form the belief it is raining outside. Do I expend any mental effort? No, it just automatically happens. I read the newspaper. I read a story in the New York Times, right? I think, for me, I'd be a little skeptical about the story because I know the New York Times has a certain kind of liberal slant. I read a story in the Washington Times, and I'd be a little less skeptical. I still have a certain amount of skepticism, but, like the individual things that are listed there, if it goes along with my previous beliefs or authorities that I respect, then I think, that's probably true. If it says something which is in huge conflict with other beliefs which have a lot of support for them, then I question it. It's like, to take like an extreme example, if your friend says, just take this. Suppose I told you I had a twin brother. He's identical to me, that we sounded alike, that we looked pretty much alike, and that we looked enough alike that in college we were able to fool my first girlfriend by switching clothes and glasses and I was posing as him and he's posing me, and in school we switched classes one time in third grade and nobody noticed. So, and you think, how does that fit in with my background? Well, there are twins. Twins are a fairly common phenomenon. You probably have known a twin, or you've seen twins on television if you don't personally know any twins. And you've seen two twins together, and you're like, damn, those people look just alike. That's incredible, right? So it's not like, it isn't not totally out of the question. But now suppose I told you another story. I told you that last night I was abducted by aliens from planet Zontar. And they told me that Barack Obama is one of their own. He's an action alien. He's not biracial. He's triracial. He's part Kenyan, part Caucasian, and then he's also part Zontarian. So you'd laugh, right? You'd think, do you have any propensity to believe that? No, right? And if you're listening to me, you're thinking, professor is insane, or this is some strange philosophical example, right, or something. But it's not. You don't think, I guess that could be true. You automatically scratch it off the list of, the things that you don't believe. You have a natural disposition not to believe. Why is that? Well, because you've never seen an alien from the planet Zontar. You probably have certain associations with aliens. And even if you believe in the alien abduction phenomena, even if you believe we're being visited, what are the chances that I was abducted and I would speak about it in such a frivolous manner? And given the philosophy professors are given to making strange examples with aliens and runaway trolleys and things, you're like, this can't be serious. And it turns out, I'll tell you, I do have a twin brother. And you can look me up on the Facebook and see a picture of my brother and see how much we look alike. But I wasn't abducted by aliens from planet Zontar, at least not that I know of. So this, when you think about this idea of how you form your beliefs, are formed in certain ways based on your experience, based on your background. What seems plausible to you is based on the sum total of your experience, the culture you live in. Now, if we were living in rural Mexico, and I told you I saw the Chupacabra the other night, you might be inclined to believe me. If you're like a peasant living on a farm, illiterate, given superstition, And if you look, you go down to South America, you'd be surprised that even people who drive around luxury cars and they're living pretty high in the hog have some pretty quirky and superstitious beliefs about, you know, South American folklore, and they might believe in the chupacabra. So it depends on where you're raised and what kind of background you have. So it's not like somebody in China, for example, wakes up one morning and they're about, 12 years old. They're kind of moving from childhood to adulthood, and they say, I really choose to believe that Buddhism is the true religion. And it's just this huge coincidence that about a billion people, well, by the time they're 12 years old and adults and able to make adult decisions, decide, I really choose to believe in this religion, as opposed to all the other religions that are out there. Why is it that all the people in China, or I should say all the people, that why isn't it that the vast majority of people in China, like, say, 95%+ believe in Buddhism or Taoism or Confucianism, or sometimes all three? Why is it the vast majority of people in India believe in Hinduism or, to a lesser extent, Islam? And why is it that the Muslims are in certain areas, like in the north? And why is it that people that grow up in North America tend to be, if they have a religion, they tend to either be secular or they tend to be a Christian of some sort? Demographics. Why is it that your parents are the largest predictor of your political beliefs? That makes it look like you don't make a free decision. It looks like your beliefs are a result of your background and experience, and you're a sort of a product of demographics. So, how about some opposing opinions on this? What do you think?
Was this just like related to James's thing about living and dead?
Yeah, that's a good point. That when he talks about what's living and dead, what seems plausible to you is going to be based on your background. But even what particular beliefs you have, not just what seems crazy and what seems believable to you, but which beliefs you choose or which beliefs you form seem to be based on accidents of geography. I sometimes show scorn and derision for people who say that's just the way I was raised when I ask them about some belief they have. When I'm asking, what rational reasons do you have, or what logical reasons do you have for believing that? What evidence is for that? And they say, I don't know, that's just the way I was raised. Right? And it seems that in a lot of ways that's kind of a lazy intellectual view in it, and in other ways it makes no sense. And sometimes I'll return with, well, if you're raised with a clown, would you be out burning a cross? And the phenomenological argument would say, well, maybe you would be, right? So it's that you're kind of you pick up the beliefs that predominate in culture and the beliefs that are passed on to you by your family. And, you know, there's complications, like maybe your father's like a stern, militant atheist, and says a lot of bad mouth religion at every moment. But maybe you had like a kind, gentle, and respectful religious neighbor who would, who would bring you cookies, right? So maybe you realize that your father, who makes religious people out to be insane monsters, and you run into your neighbors, and the wife is baking cookies for the neighborhood kids, and seems to really love people, and maybe the husband's like a PhD in history, and he's a college professor, and you're like, well, that doesn't really fit the image of what my father is saying. Maybe my father's a nut when it comes to religion. And so maybe you like have a strong reaction to atheism, and maybe go more towards belief. So it's not like you kind of robotically accept whatever your parents beliefs your parents have. Or I had a friend who's a militant atheist. He thinks religion's all bad. There's no good at all. And he had fundamentalist like parents that would beat him and lock him in the closet. Right? Well, it would be really surprising if he didn't have bad attitudes towards religion. So it can be kind of complicated. But if you look at what's going to predict what a person's religious or political beliefs are, and you look at their culture, you look at their parents, and it seems highly predictive of what they believe. You look at all the studies And then why is that? If you really have freedom with regard to your belief, why would you see these patterns? Why would most of the people in China be Buddhist or Taoist or Confucianist? Why would most of the people in India be Hindus or smaller amount Muslims? Why would almost all the people in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the Middle East be Muslim?
If you want to fit in, you don't. If the masses are believing in something, you know, you're different, then people will treat you different. You won't be a part of what's going on if you're not believing in what 95% of the people believe in.
Yeah, I suppose in some places, you know, in the Middle East, you could be executed if you're born into a Muslim family and you convert to Christianity. You're considered to be an apostate because it's assumed that you're a Muslim by being born into a Muslim family. So, but those things aside, like China, for example, they persecute Christians but they don't really promulgate any particular religious ideas. They suppress Christians in the in that group, especially the Falun Gong sect. But you know, they don't really do anything one way or the other, and people just keep on. So it's not like, and then the society, maybe there's social pressure, sure. But maybe that pressure is what creates your beliefs. Yeah, but is it? I mean, it's not like I say this. It's. I mean, are you really pressured to believe in things that people around you believe? Like, is it like you think, oh, well, all the people around me believe this, well, I'm kind of rock the boat, so I better believe that too. Or is it that it just seems normal, right? That people believe a certain thing, you're like, well, you know, it just seems obvious. Why? Because that's what everybody else believes.
I worked at a place that was in L.A. that was run by Scientologists, and anyone that was high up in the company was a full-fledged Scientologist.
Right.
That was just the way, and everyone knew that. They had outings like events to the Celebrity Center, to this L. Ron Hubbard Museum, trying to coax people to get interested in it or whatever. But all the lower people, surveyors or whatnot, they were different blocks, you know. But anyone that was high up and had a well-paying job in the company was definitely a Scientologist. And I know that there was actually people that got into the religion because they wanted to stay with the company. It was lucrative. So they actually got into the religion, which was a money machine, you know. Just you have to take all these lessons and knowledge courses, you know. And but they had I guess converted, if you will, to just so that they could be successful amongst their peers.
Yeah, and that's sort of an example of the thing that Pascal is kind of talking about. That's one way you can have a belief, and you kind of go along with it, and then maybe after a while it takes. But there's another way you could form a belief. It's just that. So if somebody give me an example, what would be a belief that like most people would have growing up in Eugene that it's so ubiquitous, or maybe just broadly growing up in America, it's so ubiquitous and so universal you don't even really think about it. It just seems like obvious to you. But maybe if you were to grow up in some other area, it seems that would be controversial, or even it might even be resistance to it. Yeah.
Smoking is harmful to your health.
Yeah, smoking bad for you. That's sort of an idea that predominates in our culture. And even people that smoke realize it's bad for them. Whereas you might, I'm trying to think of maybe in China would be a good example. They smoke a lot in China. And maybe people don't see it as being as bad for you. And if you just go back in history, you had doctors recommending brands of cigarettes, like back in even the 50s. And so that in the 50s, it didn't seem obvious that smoking was bad for you, whereas now it does. What about like the idea that you have the right to pick whatever religion you want? I mean, that's kind of like a typically American right. Or have the right to say whatever I want about politicians. I could say Bush sucks. I could say Barack Obama sucks. I could have like a picture of Barack Obama with like a swastika and Hitler mustache, and I can go and on a public street corner and I can wave my sign saying, you know, here comes the big Hitler, down with Barack Obama. And that's my right to do it. You try to do that in, you know, Indonesia or something like that, the police are going to come with their shock batons and you could be dragged off to a prison cell and worked over and beaten. You think you can do that in China? No. But it's not only that the government's going to punish you, it's that people are going to react strongly to you. Or the idea that you can say whatever you want about a religion. Right? If you in America, there's this guy, this playwright wrote this play called Corpus Christi, and it portrayed Jesus as like being a homosexual and having orgies with his disciples. And at the end, he's crucified as king of the queers, right? And you have like this play, Sister Mary. Somebody know what this Sister Mary Tells It All or something? Or is this woman dressed like a Catholic nun, playing this Catholic nun persona, making fun of Catholicism? And you know, it's just accepted. It's like, you know, people get out and they protest, and maybe they say that they don't like their religion being made fun of, but they also think that it's that person's right. You get in the Islamic countries, you get a guy that's at a beauty contest, and he says, "Oh, the women were so beautiful, any one of them might have been fit for the wife of Muhammad." You have like riots in the streets. You have people like wanting to burn down his newspaper. You have Theo van Gogh, the filmmaker, was stabbed and shot and then killed because he put out this movie about the treatment of women in Islam. You had some Danish cartoonist that had a cartoon of Muhammad where his turban was a bomb with a fuse lighting, and some other cartoons. And there were riots in the streets and people were killed over this. You never have that happen in America because people say, "Well, I might not like it, but you know, it's his right. It's your right to say whatever you want, whether it's about religion, politics, or whatever." And that seems just obvious. Whereas in other countries, it's like, "What? You can't attack our leaders. You should respect our leaders, right?" And this idea of respect for your leaders, respect for the religion that religious figures or particular religions is a cultural institution. And so apart from like the force that's used in those countries to enforce, you know, to punish people, there's just the general population thinks that's bad, it's wrong, you're a bad person if you would do something like that. So that's a good example. And generally speaking, you know, Western culture has a strong belief in the individual. Eastern culture thinks that society is more important and that the individual's rights play second fiddle to society's rights and to your obligations to society. Thoughts on that? Thoughts on differences in culture and how cultures mold your beliefs, produce your beliefs? Let's talk about the logic of belief argument. So the logic of belief argument is a different argument that says, as soon as you realize that you chose a belief for non-rational reasons, you lose confidence in that belief. So as soon as you realize you only believe something because you wanted to believe it, because you hoped it was true, you lose confidence. Now you have to pay attention to the fact when you believe something that, "Oh, I really don't have any evidence for this, I just want it to be true." But as soon as you pay attention to the fact that the only reason you believe something is because you want it to be true, you realize, well, it probably isn't true, or it doesn't seem as true as it was before. But you have to pay attention to the fact that, you know, you don't have any real evidence for it, that your reason for believing it is pragmatic, or selfish, or it's based on some desire you have, or some other non-rational consideration. Like it makes you feel good, or it... you know, it gives you a sense of purpose, or it gives you moral fortitude, or whatever it is. You think, well, okay, yeah. Like when people say, just like the example, Miss California, Miss USA, Miss America. I can't remember what pageant it was. It's that Carrie Prejean, who said, she said, "Oh, I think marriage is between a man and a woman," and she basically said she didn't approve of gay marriage. And then she had this kind of throwaway comment at the end, "No offense to anyone out there, that's just how I was raised," right? So if I took Carrie Prejean aside and said, "Look, the reason that you oppose homosexuality is if that's just because you were raised, what if you were raised in San Francisco in the Castro district, right? Would you think that you might have a different belief?" And she's like, "Well, yeah." Like, well, so And then I might ask her my subversive question, if you're raised by Klansmen, would you be out burning the cross because that's how you were raised? So the idea is that you shouldn't base your beliefs on how you were raised, you should be based your beliefs on the evidence. And once she realized that, oh, it's just the fact that I was raised by parents that told me certain things were true and false, that I believe this. It's not like I went out and found out for myself there were good reasons for believing that. Her confidence in that belief should drop, psychologically speaking. Once you realize the only reason you believe something is you hope it's true or wish it to be true, your confidence erodes in it. And so this shows that that maybe you don't have control over your beliefs. That if you believe something because you want it to be true, then it's really hard to get confidence in that belief. Because as soon as you realize, oh, I just want it to be true, I hope it's true, then you don't really believe it very strongly. So it's kind of a subtle argument about the way belief works. It's against descriptive volitionism. And essentially it says you can't really choose what to believe based on your desires, because you could... It doesn't matter how badly you want things which are pleasant to be true, reality is going to impose itself on you. Yeah.
What happens when they align, like, what you want to be true with is actually true?
That's a good day.
Yeah, it's like it's a fortuitous circumstance. Yeah, that is good. And I think it's important to recognize that just because something's pleasant or beneficial to believe doesn't mean it's false. Or that you shouldn't believe in it. You might be maybe a little more suspicious of it if it's extremely convenient. But you shouldn't be skeptical of belief just because it would be really good if it was true. But that's also not a reason to believe in it, it seems, that from a rational point of view.
Well, like saying that the weather forecast says it's going to rain tomorrow, but you really want to go snowboarding, you wake up and it's gorgeous out, and you were praying that it would be, it's just a good thing. It just worked out in your favor.
Yeah, and it's fortuitous. So, and you might think that, well, I really want to live forever. That would be cool. And if you investigate, you find out, well, I really can live forever. Should you think, well, the fact that you want to live forever, should that make you discount any evidence you might come across for the afterlife? Well, no. And just because sometimes things are true which are beneficial to you and turn out well. It's just that you... In the absence of any evidence at all, or really weak evidence, you shouldn't believe something just because it would be pleasant to believe it's true. To the extent you want to be rational. And I suppose that the final question is, if you have control over your beliefs, should you always believe what's rational, or should you maybe go along with what's pleasant to believe? Is rationality overrated?
Kierkegaard
would say, yeah.
But I mean, you look at Kierkegaard's works, and like, prior to him coming to the conclusion of like an existential existence, he sets up objective reality. He says, look, this is the way life is, this is how it is, you live, you die, that's the end of it. And he says, objectively, there's nothing there. So he says, like, after looking at it rationally, you realize how bad it is, I guess, or... And then he says, okay, so once you come to the conclusion that rationality and objectivity never satisfies passion, then you have to forsake it in favor of a leap of faith. So it's not like Kierkegaard is saying take a leap of faith in disregard rationalism. He's saying, no, once you look at rationalism in its entirety, where it begins, where it ends, it's never going to have that same fulfilling nature as abandoning it in the form of passion.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Students for Liberty's got their meeting every week now, so we'll have another meeting tomorrow at 6:00 in Building 1, 206. Ryan wanted me to make a little announcement on the faculty advisor, and we got to elect some officers and get our charter in, so stuff's happening on that front if you're interested. So we'll talk about miracles on Wednesday. So make sure to read that David Hume passage of miracles for Wednesday. And the topics are up earlier. They're up last night. So if you want to post the forum, you can do that right now.